Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 23, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. And today we welcome a guest moderator for our telephone call, Mr. Douglas Chalmers. Mr. Chalmers is the managing director of the Political Law Group. There, he practices in the area of federal and state political law and litigation. He's also a leader of the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. Mr. Chalmers, please go right ahead with the program.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm speaking to you from Atlanta, and we're honored to be participating in this panel today. We have two superb panelists who are going to be talking to us today about corporate disclosure after the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. As many of you know, there has been a significant push in a number of different respects for greater corporate disclosure of political and financial activity. And our panelists today are Jason Torchinsky. Jason is a partner at Holtzman Vogel in Washington, D.C. He is one of the finest lawyers who practices in the area of political law. We've worked together a number of times, and he is superb, and the person that I typically turn to for substantive expertise when I'm stumped. So he's an excellent lawyer. And we're also privileged to have Wes Bizzle with us today. Wes is counsel at the Altria Corporation and is also an excellent lawyer and has dealt with these issues from inside the corporate law perspective, while Jason represents corporations in private law practice. Our plan for the teleforum is we're probably going to go for about 40 minutes. Jason is going to speak first, and then Wes is going to speak after he is done. And we'll leave about 20 minutes on the back end for questions if anyone has any. And we will be able to go a little bit longer than 2 o'clock if necessary, but we're going to try and finish up right about on the hour because we understand everybody is busy. And with that, please to turn it over to Jason Torchinsky for the first part of the presentation.
Great. Thanks a lot. I want to first just talk briefly about the Citizens United decision itself and what it did, and then I'm going to address some of the misunderstandings that have arisen from it and then some of the legislation and other activities that have followed up on the Citizens United decision. The Citizens United decision was a relatively narrow decision that struck down essentially the prohibition on corporations using corporate dollars to make independent expenditures supporting or opposing candidates. And it's very, very clear that I want to stress it is only about independent expenditures. Citizens United does not permit corporate contributions directly to any federal candidate anywhere, and it doesn't impact any of the state laws that prohibit corporate dollars from going directly to candidates. It's only about independent expenditures. So I want to sort of go through some of the misunderstandings that have been out there in the media, both in the legal press and in the sort of broader press as well, about kind of what's happening, and then I want to talk about a bit of the debate. First of all, super PACs that everybody talks about disclose virtually all their donors and all their disbursements and spend up to 100% of their funds on political activity. I say virtually all their donors because essentially anybody that gives them less than $200 and any disbursements less than $200, they don't disclose. But super PACs file with the FEC, they register, they report, they file on the same schedule as every leadership PAC in Washington, D.C. or anywhere else in the country. So super PACs are disclosed, so anybody that tells you super PACs don't disclose, they're just flat wrong. Corporate disbursements for contributions to candidates in states where they're permissible and corporate disbursements for ballot initiative spending out in the states is also public information and is readily accessible. The same is true when a trade association makes a contribution to a candidate or for a ballot initiative. It's publicly available information and is generally readily accessible, and almost every state has this information available online in some format. A lot of the post-Citizens United debate really has been a focus on organizations that don't disclose donors and engage in political activity. And there really are two kinds of those in general. There are 501c4s, which are social welfare organizations, and there are 501c6s, which are trade associations. First, I want to talk about 501c4s. You had groups out there like Priorities USA, you have groups out there like Americans for Prosperity, and the one that the left likes to attack is Crossroads GPS, and the one that the right likes to attack is Organizing for America. All of these are organized under Section 501c4 of the Internal Revenue Code. They are limited by the IRS rules in their political activity because social welfare has to be their primary purpose. Exactly what that line is and exactly what constitutes political activity is probably worthy of its own separate teleforum. Needless to say, the IRS definition of political activity is vague compared to the FEC definition of political activity, which is much more narrow and has been tested in a whole long series of court cases over the last 40 years. The 501c4s, the left likes to call them dark money groups, they've been targeted by activists because they don't disclose their donors generally unless a donor gives to support a particular advertisement. And you see almost no instances in the disclosure forms of any organization saying that any donor gave to support a particular advertisement. You know, while a lot of the focus has been on these groups, I just want to put their independent expenditure activity in perspective. If you look at Center for Responsive Politics, which categorizes and catalogs a lot of this information on their website, they were able to figure out that 151 C4s made independent expenditures in 2012. Their total independent expenditure amount by all of these C4s combined was about $254 million. While that sounds like, and it is a big number in isolation, when you put it in perspective, the FEC came out this week and said $7 billion was spent by political committees, excluding all of these outside groups, in 2012. So the IE spending that everybody is screaming about from C4s accounted for about 3.6% of the total political spending in 2012. Similarly, with 501c6 organizations, these are trade associations. And for those of you that represent corporations, this is where I believe that there's this myth out there among activists who think that corporations are literally shoveling money into trade associations, and then the trade associations are shoveling money out the door to quote-unquote take advantage of the Citizens United decision and spend all this unlimited, undisclosed corporate money on political activity. And I think if you look at the reality of it, again, that's not true. Again, I think they're targeted by activists because they don't disclose and they feel like there's this belief that they engage in a lot of political activity. I also think that there is a belief out there among some activists who believe that targeting trade associations is a good way to try to silence the business community in the policy debate because, frankly, on the unpopular issues, it is often the trade associations that take the lead rather than any individual company. And again, you know, when you talk about political activity that these groups can do post-Citizens United, again, I cite to Center for Responsive Politics as the data catalog for the source. They said that there were 9 501c6 organizations that spent in 2012 for a total of $55 million in independent expenditures. And if you look sort of in more detail at the data, it turns out that two 501c6 organizations, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a group called Americans for Job Security, spent about $47 million of that $55 million, meaning basically two 501c6s of the somewhere upwards of 90,000 trade associations in the U.S. Spent 85% of the reported federal independent expenditures. And again, if you put that sort of in perspective with the idea that $7 billion was spent on politics last cycle, by political committees, you see that comes to about 0.8% of the political spending. I also want to knock down the sort of misunderstanding that corporations are, to a massive degree, funding super PACs. I believe that to be generally not true, and some of the data bears that out. In 2012, there was a state-based question about whether a state could limit independent expenditures in a case called American Tradition Partnership, and Senator McConnell filed a brief where he looked, and in the brief he provided the court some data. He looked at all of the $100 million or so that was raised by all of the super PACs that were supporting various candidates in the Republican presidential primary in 2012, and here's what he found. 86% of the funding came from individuals, 12% of the funding came from privately held corporations, and less than 1% of the funding was from publicly traded companies. I think it came out to about 0.86% of the $100 million had come from publicly traded companies. So that said, now that I've knocked down some of the myths, I want to go through some of the legislative and judicial activity and legislative activity that has come sort of out of that. At the state level, we have seen some states try to buck this trend and sort of fight the concept of super PACs. Really, there are only about three states left that are trying to fight it. One is New Jersey, where a lawsuit was just filed against them about 2 weeks ago, and the other is New York, where I am actually representing a plaintiff attempting to allow super PACs to be permitted in New York. short of trying to limit independent expenditures, there has actually been a series of states, probably a half dozen or so, that have passed legislation that will essentially require 501c4s that engage in political activity or 501c6s that engage in political activity in their state to engage in some degree of donor disclosure. And it varies across the half dozen states or so as to how far they go. I expect that there will be some legal challenges to some of those. But at the state level, if your clients are going to engage in corporate political activity, you got to be really careful, you know, whether they're doing it directly or indirectly through a trade association. There is state level legislation that you've got to be aware of. At the federal level, a lot of the campaign finance reform efforts post Citizens United have not gotten very far. There were two versions of a law called the Disclose Act, both of which would have had very, very broad disclosure for essentially any group that engages in even the smallest bit of political activity. In 2010, it was defeated on the Disclose Act of 2010 was defeated on a cloture vote in the Senate. Subsequently, this past year, the Disclose Act of 2012 was reintroduced. The Disclose Act of 2012 was reintroduced. It got some press attention when it was introduced, and they tried to trim back some of the disclosure because they had run into kind of a buzzsaw of groups on the left and right that didn't want disclosure to the degree they wanted it in 2010. They tried to walk it back a bit, and it still didn't go anywhere. It was referred to a committee, and no further action was taken. There is new legislation about to be proposed. This is the Murkowski-Wyden bill. Senator Murkowski and Senator Wyden both wrote a joint op-ed in the Washington Post a few months ago, kind of outlining their broad concepts for their so-called bipartisan bill. And just, I think, about a day or two ago, there was a report that said that they're about to release their legislative language. So the details of that bill are a bit unclear, but it's something that needs to be on the horizon for anybody that's advising any corporation or trade association that is thinking about engaging in any kind of political activity. Within the executive branch, there have been a couple of attempts to try to engage in some post-Citizens United rulemaking. One was a trial balloon floated by the White House that would have been an executive order that would have required government contractors to disclose in their proposals or contract bids information on political donations by their officers and directors. It was floated by the White House, and it was universally panned by just about everybody that looked at it except for the activists. And so it didn't go anywhere. But if you think about the number of companies that do some business somewhere with the federal government, it would have resulted in a lot of disclosure about the personal giving of a lot of people. The FEC essentially has not yet engaged in any post-Citizens United rulemaking. In fact, a lot of the corporate regulations that say corporations can't engage in IEs are still technically in the reg book because the FEC hasn't been able to get together and agree on which of their regulations need to be excised, although I think there is at least some agreement among the commissioners that a lot of those regulations are just wholly unenforceable. With electioneering communications, and this is a category of sort of political activity that some people believe is political activity that involve ads, broadcast ads that mention or refer to candidates in time periods close in time to election, but don't necessarily cross over into that express advocacy threshold where you're telling somebody to vote for or against the candidate. The FEC, following some litigation that I'm going to talk about, declined to reopen that rulemaking. They split on a 3-3 vote, and so changes to the electioneering communications rules from the FEC have not moved anywhere. The SEC is kind of the next, or appears to be the next battleground for sort of action here. Some action from the SEC is potentially pending. The SEC included in December of last year, included in its semiannual regulatory agenda, that its staff was considering proposing to the commission something on political activity disclosure by publicly traded companies. Activists on the left have generated about 500,000 or so, essentially repetitive comments from the so-called public, although it's concentrated among union members, urging SEC action on this issue, and we just haven't seen anything yet. We don't know exactly what they're going to do, and we don't know the timing of when they might do it, and we're not really sure what the scope of what they might do might look like. Some of it may require disclosure of direct corporate political contributions all in one place rather than having to go chase down things through state websites. There's a possibility regulations could reach into disclosure of political contributions by corporate officers and directors. There's also a possibility that it could get into the issue of corporate contributions to trade associations or other kinds of nonprofits more in one place. So we really don't know what the SEC is going to do. But obviously, everybody that practices in this area is kind of watching it. The other place that we have seen a lot of activity in this area is in the shareholder activism and kind of in the proxy season. Certain shareholder activist groups have pressed companies for disclosure of political contributions and contributions to trade associations, along with policies detailing kind of the rationale and the accountability for those kinds of contributions. Some companies have reached settlements with some of the activists, and I'll kind of leave this to Wes to talk more about because Altria has reached some agreements. But the companies that have faced shareholder proposals have generally, you know, sought to reach some kind of accommodation. And sometimes you're able to do that and get the proxy proposals withdrawn. Other times you're not, and the proxy proposal goes to a vote. There were 88 lobbying or political activity proxy proposals in 2011. There were 105 in 2013. Just recently in the news, for example, the Starbucks shareholders defeated a proposal that would have prohibited all political contributions by Starbucks. Not that Starbucks has ever made any political contributions, but there was this proposal to just prohibit the company from doing it, and it didn't pass. Average support for these shareholder proposals when they actually go to a vote has been, 30% or less, and the support has actually dropped from 2011 to 2012. Interesting to note that a lot of the sort of large institutional shareholders have not supported these shareholder proposals. There has been one lawsuit filed against the corporation, and some of you may have heard about it. It was a lawsuit brought by the New York State Comptroller against Qualcomm in Delaware Chancery Court, where they were seeking access to essentially Qualcomm's books and records as they related to political contributions and trade associations and contributions to other nonprofits. The litigation was proceeding along, and I believe that Qualcomm, just looking at it from the outside, I believe Qualcomm was in a pretty good litigating position under Delaware law. And Qualcomm, in the end, actually wound up reaching a settlement. And I think that the settlement was really a result of a cost-benefit analysis where somebody inside the corporation general counsel's office looked and said, okay, what are we protecting here, spending whatever we're spending to litigate this lawsuit? And they looked at the list and said, you know what, we're going to spend a whole lot of money to protect something that really isn't harmful if we disclose it in the end. And so they ultimately reached a settlement and disclosed, and the lawsuit was withdrawn, so there was actually no court decision that told them that they had to do it. So hopefully we won't see too many more of those lawsuits, but hopefully if they keep pushing it, hopefully some corporation will actually say no and we'll get a good litigated decision out of the Delaware courts at some point. I also want to mention briefly the Van Hollen litigation. It's been kind of on and off in the news. Congressman Van Hollen is leading a court effort to overturn an FEC rule on disclosure of donations related to electioneering communications. Again, electioneering communications aren't express advocacy, but they are aired close in time to elections. Congressman Van Hollen wants any group that engages in an electioneering communication to disclose all donors of over $1,000 to that group for the last two calendar years that make any kind of electioneering communication, regardless of the size of the electioneering communications expense or the purpose of the donor in giving to the organization. The case started in the district court, and Congressman Van Hollen prevailed in the spring of 2012 there. And essentially what you saw was every organization that had engaged in electioneering communications switched their communications last year and engaged in express advocacy instead. So there were virtually no electioneering communications by anybody that would have resulted in that broad disclosure. Late last year, and I just full disclosure, I'm representing an intervener defendant in this case. In late 2012, the D.C. Circuit reversed the district court, and the case was remanded back to the district court for further proceedings. We're in the middle of doing some briefing there that's due mid – I think the last piece of paper is due mid-May, and then we're back to the district judge for further proceedings in that case. So that case is still alive, and we'll see where it goes. I guess bottom line for my points, and then I'll turn it over to Wes before we take some questions, is disclosure is a big issue for certain groups of activists. I think they are relatively small in number, but I think they are quite vocal. If you're facing a disclosure proposal, I would say it's important to assess all of the interests within your company or organization and make an assessment about how to approach the proposal and the proponents of the proposal. I would say, get a sense within the company of the tolerance for accommodating or resisting, and know the motivations of the proponents. There was a recent joint letter that some of you may have seen released by the U.S. Chamber and Business Roundtable and NAM providing some pretty forceful points if you're going to resist or negotiate against the disclosure proposal. A lot of the factual charges that the activists make were rebutted in that letter. And the letter also sort of speaks to what at least the Chamber of Business Roundtable and NAM suggest are the motivations of some of these groups, which is to try to drown out the voice of business in the political process, which I think is the conclusion of the letter. And I think the letter was saying, you know, please don't let these activists, you know, drive business out of the policy discussion. And I guess with that, I will turn it over to Wes, because Altria has had some experience with this.
Great. Thanks, Jason. As Doug mentioned, I am Wes Bazell. I'm an assistant general counsel for Altria Client Services, and I oversee the political law compliance program for Altria and its companies. For those of you not familiar with Altria, Altria Group is the parent company of Philip Morris USA, which makes Marlboro, a cigar company called John Middleton, U.S. Smokeless Tobacco, which makes Skoal in Copenhagen, and St. Michelle Wine Estate, which makes Stag's Leap Wine Vineyards, Arras, and a number of other wines. As Jason mentioned, the context that we're talking about today is against the issue that we're talking about today is against the backdrop of some recent information that the FEC just published showing a little over $7 billion spent in the 2013 federal election cycle. That is about $1.7 billion more than was spent in the 2008 presidential cycle. But, you know, as Jason mentioned, you know, those numbers are large, but you have to put them into some context. And I would tell you that in 2012, the Americans spent $8 billion on Halloween candy decorations and costumes. So comparatively, $7 billion may not be a large amount of money spending on electing our nation's leaders. There has been especially since Citizens United, a dramatic increase in interest in political spending. Certainly the media has focused on it. As Jason said, administrative agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission appear to be at least looking at it, although I understand that a bill was filed this week in the House that would actually bar the SEC from rulemaking on this issue. Legislative bodies at both the federal and state and sometimes even local levels are looking at it, and including not only from a legislative perspective but from an investigation perspective as well. Senator Levin, who is the chair of the U.S. Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, has indicated that he would like to hold investigatory hearings on the role of money in politics, specifically with regard to these C4 and C6 organizations. And then, you know, really the topic of our conversation today is there are shareholders and what are known as socially responsible investors who have a strong interest in this, as well as a number of organized groups such as the Center for Political Accountability, there's the Corporate Reform Coalition, the Coalition for Accountability and Political Spending, which is a group of state comptrollers and treasurers, as well as others within the general public who've expressed a strong interest. So this is the backdrop in what has propelled the shareholder resolutions that are being filed. And with regards to political contributions, you know, I'm a compliance lawyer who specializes in political activities, and I will readily admit that risks do exist in this area. Clearly, there are potential legal liabilities for companies engaging in the political process. There is a complex web of state laws regarding this area, and you know, quite frankly, this is what employs Doug, Jason, and me. So we appreciate the complexity of the law, but it is not intuitive. It is rarely intuitive, and a company that is not careful can easily get tripped up within the legal framework. There are additionally potentially reputational liabilities, especially if one violates the law. And what we've seen in a couple of instances in the 2012 cycle, companies that provide contributions occasionally get caught up and become fodder in political campaigns. PG&E in the 2012 cycle made a $10,000 contribution to a super PAC that was supporting a member of Congress in a Democratic member of Congress in a intra-party race. It was in California. His opponent used that contribution that was being made and highlighted it within an ad, noting the PG&E contribution to his opponent, and also noting that same company owned the pipeline in San Bruno, California, that exploded a couple years before and killed a number of people. So not only are there legal and reputational risks regarding your own activities, you occasionally get caught up in the political campaigns of others simply by participating. Now, from my standpoint, and I'm speaking as an individual here, the question is not whether to engage in the political process, but really how to engage thoughtfully and responsibly. Obviously, public policy decisions made at the federal, state, and local levels can have a profound and do have a profound effect on corporations. And so a company that engages in the political process and political activity really needs to identify and manage the issues and potential risks that can come about if they decide to be active in that process. I don't think this is any different from any other governance issue. So just as other risk factors that a company faces with political activity, a company needs to have a clear set of and strong foundation of principles, policies, and processes to ensure a good risk management of these types of activities. Here at Altria, we have a very comprehensive political law compliance program, and we are proud of our leadership within the general corporate community on these issues. I won't go into a lot of detail about our program, but it does specifically cover lobbying, political contributions, these contributions to charitable and nonprofit entities that Jason mentioned, as well as gifts to government officials. What we've heard and what I've heard with engaging in folks in this area and is that from a shareholder perspective or an interested party perspective, it is difficult to access state-level political contribution data, and there is a concern about the oversight mechanisms a company might have in place. So to address the access issue and also the oversight issue, Altria has for many years made disclosures of its political activities on its website since 2007, and we have regularly reviewed that and made periodic enhancements to those disclosures. So on Altria.com, we discuss the general oversight mechanisms that we provide to both our lobbying and political contribution activities. We note the specific board oversight that exists. We discuss in some detail the policies and procedures that govern our giving, our political giving. And we also, on the legislative side, discuss not only the issues about which we care about most, but we provide direct links to our Federal Lobbying Disclosure Act reports that's filed with the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And also, we provide direct links to the state disclosure websites with which we file our state lobbying reports. Altria files probably about 450 lobbying and political contribution reports every year, so obviously providing all of that information on the website would be pretty overwhelming. And so we have decided to provide these links directly to the disclosure databases so that someone can go to our website and find out what we've been lobbying on, what expenses we may have had regarding our government affairs activities in a particular state. And then Since 2007, we've disclosed information regarding our political contributions. And that information today includes specific contributions broken out by state to candidates, parties, PACs, 527 organizations, ballot measure committees, and any other political committees. So given that many of you are probably working in corporations, I wanted to spend a little bit of time and talk about, you know, what a company should think about if it is to receive a shareholder resolution regarding its corporate political activity. As Jason said, there are, you know, right now we're seeing in the last couple of years, they're hitting in the low triple digits, usually over 100 now in any given year are being filed. And so, you know, and there are a lot of companies that receive a shareholder resolution but don't take them to a vote. They negotiate an agreement and the resolution is withdrawn by the proponents. So what happens if you are to get this resolution? You know, my suggestion, first of all, would be take a step back and do some self-examination of the oversight mechanisms that your company has. One of the things that these resolutions typically ask for is some discussion of policies. And so, you know, look to see if you have written policies regarding your political giving. Certainly policies are a necessary part of any compliance program, even in this area, but they're not necessarily sufficient. You have to have more than just written policies. You need to have, in addition, adequate procedural controls on how those political spending decisions are made, who approves the political spending, and what reviews from a reputational and legal perspective that those contribution requests go through. All of that doesn't help you if you don't have some type of training program to inform those who are governed by those policies what their requirements are. So you have to look and see if you have a training program. Compliance, in my view, is not akin to the field of dreams. It's not a situation of if you build it, they will come. You've got to not just design a compliance program, you've got to implement it. And training is a necessary component of such an implementation. And then, you know, what I often say when I speak on these issues is you also have to think about what I call the Goldilocks rule. Every company is different, and this is not a one-size-fits-all proposition. So the policies and procedures and controls that a company like Altria has may not be right for a company that rarely engages in the political process. So you've got to make sure that, you know, under the Goldilocks rule, your porridge is not too hot and too cold. It's just right for your company. So after you do that self-examination, you need to look outward. What do others view of your activities? Luckily, there's an easy place to go for that. The Center for Political Accountability has teamed with the Wharton School and have a yearly CPA Zicklin Index that is on the Center for Political Accountability's website that ranks the Fortune 200 companies on disclosure issues. There's a similar index called the Baruch Index, a college in New York City, that does similar ranking system for disclosures. So look to those, that is two separate groups' opinion of what companies do, but it is they have become sort of the standard for grading, if you will, disclosures in this area. And then, of course, look to see what peers or other companies are doing. The indices that I just talked about provide helpful resource in that regard. You can, if your peers are outside the Fortune 200, you can go to those corporate websites and poke around and see what disclosures are made. And then there is another organization of which I'm a member of, for Altria, and it's the Conference Board Political Spending Committee. And their website is conferenceboard.org/political spending. And that website, it has a lot of information about what other companies are doing. It provides not a, we try not to provide a best practices approach. We provide examples of what companies are doing in this space. There are a couple of handbooks that we have published over the past few years regarding political spending and really the types of decisions that companies should think about, the types of issues companies should think about when engaging in political spending. It's, the committee is made up of a number of companies, including Altria, Microsoft, Campbell Soup, Pfizer, Coca-Cola, and others. And after you really look at, you know, sort of get a feel of the landscapes, look internally, look externally, look to see how you are rated, my suggestion is that engagement is always beneficial in this area. First of all, and if the past is any indication, the SEC is very unlikely to provide a no action letter. Typically, the only times in recently that they've provided no action letters on these issues would be if there was a technical flaw in the proposal or the proposal was duplicative. So where you have received multiple proposals regarding your disclosure of political contributions, the SEC has allowed companies to omit the second resolution from their proxy. But in my opinion, engagement with the proponents is helpful. It's an opportunity for discussion. You know, you may not always agree. You may not even come to an agreement. But, you know, I certainly believe that in this area, with regard to most any resolution, discussion is much better than confrontation. And, you know, keep in mind that this is not an issue that's going to disappear. This is not something that will be here for one proxy season and the proponents are going to lose interest. This started about 10 years ago. I think the first proposal on this issue was in 2004, and it certainly gained a lot of prominence and attention since the Citizens United decision. And most importantly, the investment advisory firms, such as the Institutional Shareholder Services, are starting to support disclosures. The ISS has moved from a case-by-case determination to a generally support disclosures of political spending and lobbying spending. And, you know, and also as you engage in these discussions, as you look at what you do, realize that disclosures are going to vary widely. Companies take different approaches. Companies have different thresholds that they utilize. They have, as Jason mentioned, they have different competing interests internally and externally that govern their decision making in this regard. And so, you know, again, this is not necessarily a one-size-fits-all disclosure regime, just as it's not a one-size-fits-all compliance regime. And finally, a few more things before we wrap up for questions. You know, if you don't have a proposal, that's great. But, you know, it probably will do you some good if you prepare now, as it may be coming. Like I said, this is not an issue that is going to disappear. So, you know, for those of you who work for companies that do not have a proposal for the 2013 season, I would still suggest you look at your CPA Zicklin score and your Baruch College score. Look at the Center for Political Accountability's model resolution, because the vast majority of these political spending disclosure requests are based on that model resolution. And then, you know, look to see what types of shareholder resolutions your peers, your corporate peers are receiving. And so with that, I will, unless Jason has...
I just want to make one comment on the ISS views. ISS, I think, has generally switched to a pro-disclosure thing, but I think when you're dealing with ISS, if you are dealing with ISS, I think it's important to point out to them that their general comments may not apply to the specific proposal in front of your company. I was just dealing with that for a client recently where they essentially suggested voting for a proposal that didn't actually do what they said – why they said you should vote for it. The actual language of the proposal was totally disconnected from what it was that they were claimed to be asserting in their recommendation to vote for it. So be careful and be detailed when you're dealing with sort of outside advisors on proxy proposals. I guess, Doug, do you want to moderate questions?
Sure. Just listening to this, before we get to questions, it occurred to me it might be helpful for us to explain a little bit about what types of disclosures are most commonly seen in the shareholder resolutions that are being submitted. In other words, what are folks trying to get disclosed which are not things that are not already currently being disclosed under FEC rules or lobbying disclosure reports? What are you seeing?
This is Wes Bazell. I mean, a lot of it that they are asking for is already publicly disclosed. You know, it's just disclosed over a number of different databases within either the federal government or across the state governments. So it's political contributions to candidates and parties and PACs, your normal political contributions. They're also asking for disclosure of independent expenditures. You know, as Jason said, it is still pretty rare for companies to engage in independent expenditures, so that most companies are not buying a television ad that says vote for or vote against a specific candidate. And they're also asking for contributions to trade associations and 501c4 social welfare groups. Now, most of that is not disclosed. And then they're asking for just general sort of oversight mechanisms on the political spending, for instance. You know, what is the approval process for making a political contribution? Who approves it? And, you know, what are the criteria that the company utilizes before for making those contributions? And then on the lobby side, they're asking for general expenditures regarding lobbying activities, both direct lobbying, the lobbying of legislators, or grassroots lobbying, you know, asking voters to contact their legislators on a specific issue.
Jason, do you see this at all tying into how Citizens United handled the shareholder protection rationale? And maybe you want to talk a little bit about what the court did with that.
Yeah, I mean, the court pretty summarily dismissed the shareholder protection rationale. One of the interests that the government advanced as to why there should be this prohibition on corporate independent expenditures was to protect the rights of dissenting shareholders. And the court essentially looked at the exemption that's in campaign finance law for media companies, you know, GE, NBC, the New York Times Company, the Washington Post Company, and basically said, no, that's not a valid rationale, because if that were a valid rationale, you would permit the government to then limit the speech of media entities. And so the court did a pretty quick dismissal of the notion of dissenting shareholder rights, but also said that, you know, essentially corporate democracy could take care of that problem, which is part of the reason I think that these folks pushing these shareholder resolutions feel like they're on pretty good ground there, because the court told them, hey, go take care of it with corporate democracy if you don't like what's happening, and so that's what they're trying to do.
Makes sense. Well, should we go ahead, Dean, and open it up to questions from the audience?
Sounds perfect. We've got quite a few people on the line.
In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our panel members, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Hold on for that announcement. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on our telephone. Our phone lines are open, and while we're waiting to see if there are questions, let me make an announcement about the rest of this week's Teleform conference calls. We have one for each of the remaining days of the week. Tomorrow, on Wednesday at 2 p.m., we have a Teleform call looking at restoring the rule of law in Venezuela. Thursday at noon, we'll be discussing the perceived war on women. And then Friday at 1 p.m., Missouri versus McNeely, that concerns the warrantless blood tests for alcohol in criminal cases. Again, our phone lines are open. We don't have any caller questions at this point. You need to push the star button and then the pound button in order to join the conversation. Doug, I'll come back to you. I'll break in when we have questions from the audience. Our lines are open, but if you
sure.
want to continue the discussion among yourselves, why don't you go right ahead?
Be happy to. I've actually got a question for Wes. It occurs to me that we may have, you know, a number of folks on the line who are in-house counsel, and you mentioned that you at Altria conduct training programs. What are the two or three issues which you think are most important for in-house counsel to include in those kinds of training programs?
Well, on the political contribution side, especially for a large company, the political contributions really need to come, you know, from the government affairs department. And so to manage the process, first of all, and to inform your employees what, you know, what a political contribution is and how it should be processed from sort of a contextual standpoint, because, you know, in my experience, your sort of average run-of-the-mill employee may not understand that providing your company's conference room to a, you know, local city council or mayoral candidate to host an event, generally in most states, is a political contribution. And so really setting the requirements and just some basic educational level about what is a political contribution, what is a lobbying contact, because, you know, most people have a perception in their mind that may not always comport with what the law is. Like I said earlier, these laws are very complex and are, especially in this area, are rarely intuitive.
I mean, this is Jason. From my perspective, I have seen a number of corporate clients where particularly lower-level people, regional managers, people that think they have some authority to make a political contribution, do it and then don't realize that they can't have done it. And so I have seen a problem in companies where political contribution stuff is not centralized for legal review. That's opened up a number of companies to a lot of problems.
One of the things that we have seen in our own practice is actually with large national corporations, they have a difficult time sometimes keeping track of what is a corporate contribution or a political contribution as opposed to a lobbying expenditure. And in Wes's case, you know, I was reading your bio where you have 65 different jurisdictions where you have to keep track of the differences in state law compliance requirements there. How do you all manage to do that, given the number of different areas you have to keep track of and monitor?
Well, you know, as Jason said, it's all centralized. We have a, you know, very clear written policies that are, you know, sort of in the framework of compliance is supported from, you know, what we call tone at the top. So communications from the most senior people within our company. And then to, you know, from an in-house perspective is I'm, you know, sort of separating the government affairs employees who are the most active in this area, obviously, but with the sort of the general population of your company. But for that general population, you've got to, you know, make it known that you're the resource and make it as easy as possible for individuals to come to you and seek guidance. The problem, of course, is the more difficult it is to get an opinion from an internal counsel, the more likely it is that people will, seek forgiveness later, which is typically not a good idea for a compliance perspective.
Doug, this is Dean breaking in here. We have a caller question if we want to go to the audience.
Sure.
We have one question at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski, New York. Got a maybe a little off-the-wall question, but has anyone thought about the possibility of an end run around Citizens United and banning political contributions, a la Obamacare, by way of taxing political contributions in a way so effectively prohibit them?
That's an interesting question, and this is sort of the IRS backstory on these on political contributions by corporations. Under Section 162E, the IRS prohibits businesses from taking deductions for lobbying or political activity, and they include political contributions in there. So, for example, when I gave you the example of these super PACs that had taken, the 12% of the $100 million or so that had come from privately held companies, those guys actually paid a 35% tax on that $12 million. Had they taken that out as some kind of distribution and then paid, and then made their $12 million contribution, they would have paid a whole lot less in taxes on it because obviously their distribution wouldn't be taxed as a profit. So, like, for example, if a corporation gives, I'll give you a perfect example because this one's been in the news. Chevron gave $1 million to a super PAC. Chevron can't deduct that $1 million, and Chevron's going to pay $350,000 in taxes on that $1 million contribution. So I think a lot of companies don't necessarily realize that until their tax departments get involved. I mean, I guess you could envision legislation where they tax political contributions somehow higher, although I don't know that anybody's really talked about that. So the bottom line is there is a tax on political contributions right now. Again, not widely reported and not well known outside of corporate tax departments, but it's there.
Thank you.
Dean, do we have any other questions from the audience?
Well, not at this point.
Okay.
Anybody can join the conversation by pushing star and then pound, though, if you'd like to join the conversation.
Well, we have just a couple of more minutes, and one question I had for both of our panelists is I was focusing on Jason's statistics in particular about how there has not been a dramatic increase on corporate spending on independent expenditures after Citizens United. That really sort of begs the question, is all this press for more corporate disclosure much ado about nothing? And I'm curious what you both see are the trends coming forward about corporate spending on independent expenditures.
I think the press from the activists is really more about corporate involvement in the policy debates through trade associations than it really is about independent expenditures. I think a lot of corporations, I mean, look, we have 70 years where business executives were told that they couldn't do independent expenditures. So I think it's going to take a while before any big corporation wants to spend any kind of substantial money directly on any kind of federal election. That said, I think that these activists, I kind of agree with what the Chamber and Business Roundtable and NAM said in their letter. I think the activists are really after these corporations because they want to try to discourage their participation in trade associations that take, let's call it more controversial positions on various issues. For example, the Chamber has been out there on immigration. The Chamber has been out there on energy. I mean, you kind of name the organization or name the major trade association, and you often see the major trade associations taking positions that are contrary to what a lot of these activists really want in terms of sort of broader policy issues.
And this is what, companies especially, the Fortune 500, Fortune 200, are going to be cautious in this area. I think Jason has a great point is, for 70 years, they've been told they can't do it at the federal level. Some states have always allowed it, and, states continue to allow corporate contributions directly to candidates. But, I think that companies, by their nature, are risk-averse, and they're not going to be want to be the first or even the 12th or the 20th to make a large independent expenditure contribution. And especially companies that, you know, rely on consumers, you know, no matter no matter where you come, if you make a independent expenditure, you're taking out an ad for or against a candidate, you're likely going to be alienating some portion of those people who buy your products. And so I think companies realize that and are, you know, like I said, risk adverse to engage in that type of activity at this point.
I mean, Target wound up with egg all over its face about 2 or 3 years ago, where it gave to a state-based super PAC in Minnesota that was supporting a candidate who opposed some, I think it was some gay rights issues, and gay rights activists jumped all over Target, tried to organize boycotts, and Target wound up entering into some basically settlement agreement with them where they became sort of overly protective of gay rights as a result of making a contribution to a candidate or a super PAC supporting a candidate that was perceived to be against gay rights. So, you know, that was one where Target just, I think, just stepped into it in a way that I don't think they intended at all. Other than, you know, it was a guy who was running for governor in their home state. So I think that was an example of the unintended consequences that sometimes come from corporate political involvement.
And I'll,
well, Dean, sorry, go ahead.
And well, and just on sort of the news front, as you all know, you know, News Corp was facing a shareholder derivative suit regarding the phone hacking scandal in England, and I think press came out this week. They settled that derivative suit. Which, of course, had nothing to do with political giving by the company, but part of that settlement was that they are going to enhance their governance procedures, including disclosure of political contributions made by the company. So these issues can come about, I think, in a variety of ways where, you know, an unintentional a contribution to what a company thinks is a pro-business candidate and failing to recognize that that candidates or other legislative stances may not align with what the company publicly supports, or a completely separate and totally independent compliance issue that arises that gets the company caught up in you know, political contribution disclosure sort of tacked on to whatever investigation is already underway.
Dean, this is Doug, and by my clock, we're right at 2 o'clock. If we don't have any questions from the audience, any additional questions, I think we're probably at a good point to wrap up.
Very good. Well, this is Dean again, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all three of our panelists for joining us today, and Doug Chalmers in particular for helping us put this program together. It's certainly been interesting. I invite you all, the audience, to join us for our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing the return to the rule of law in Venezuela. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.